America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, one of my favorite past guests is returning to America Trends. His name is Joseph Michelli, and I'm sure you remember the first podcast that we did with him about the Airbnb way.
Yeah, that was a very interesting podcast, and a lot of stuff I hadn't heard before about that. So, I'm anxious to hear his new book. What's he writing about now?
Well, first I want to tell you what he was writing about, and then he had to stop because of the pandemic and alter his focus. First of all, he writes about a lot of individual companies, did a great book about Starbucks, another one about Mercedes-Benz, Driven to Delight. I mean, he's a remarkable writer and presenter about business. And it was so interesting. He was working on a book about Godiva chocolates. Can you imagine that, John? What a delight that would have been, working on that book, because you had to get free samples to get motivated, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think you have to sample everything in order to write a comprehensive book on that.
Yeah. So I guess if you're writing about Starbucks, you're sitting at Starbucks writing about it, I would imagine, and Godiva the same way. Well, it would have been a good time, because I think a lot of people during the pandemic, and we're talking here about him looking into issues related to business acumen during the pandemic. I don't know if you've noticed this, John, but a lot of people are putting on weight. Did you notice that during the pandemic?
Less things you can do, right? You can't go places. So that, I believe that to be true.
Well, in fact, a friend of mine was on a video call with his doctor. And so the doctor said to him, well, I can't weigh you here, so tell me, what do you weigh? How much have you put on during the pandemic, if anything? And he said, well, I put on about 8 pounds. And the doctor said, oh, that's good, because most people have put on 15. And then looking at the video screen that he was on with his doctor, he said to himself, and he told me, my doctor looked like he had put on 20 pounds.
Well, Larry, you know this. The camera can put some weight on you.
Well, I said that to him, having been in television all those years. That's what I would always say when somebody said, have you put on a little weight? Well, I'll tell you one guy who hasn't put on any weight because he's been so busy working during the pandemic, and that is this Joseph Michelli. And what he decided to do was put down the book that he was working on and write another book called Stronger Through Adversity, where he really said, this is an incredible moment as a writer about business, how people deliver everything that is necessary during a period like this to really lead a team that is very confused, perplexed, isolated. All the circumstances that are normal in your business environment are upended. So who better than Joseph Michelli to say, let me document this in real time. And that's what he's done in this book.
Well, do you really think about it? You really do need a team, because here you have to figure out how to do things new. Plus, you're up against the big monster, of course, Amazon, who was already in the zone. So I can imagine for business, it must have been really crazy.
So what he decided to do, John, he's got an incredible Rolodex, I would imagine, as somebody who has written so extensively about business, and he contacted over 140 senior leaders at major companies about their specific challenges and how they were meeting them. And he got raw, yet very thoughtful, real-time insights into the crisis that will define an entire generation of leaders. And he decided not to look only at business, but also at nonprofit leaders, because you can imagine, John, during this period, nonprofit organizations, many of whom have become much more important than ever, are facing the same challenges as for-profit businesses.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of them, you know, had to shut down for a while to figure, you know, this out. And, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. They're up against it hard because they're expecting people to give, and communicating with people at this point is very hard.
Absolutely. So many common challenges, and so many challenges that are unique to one company or one industry or another, as we begin to rebuild our economy going forward in a totally different light. Pretty soon, John, we're going to be doing a podcast about the new delivery economy. That, of course, is part of the consideration here, as you mentioned, Amazon. So much to really digest, and nobody better to do it with than Joseph Michelli today on America Trends. With me on America Trends is an old friend of this podcast, Joseph Michelli. And you might remember, and go back and take a look at it, it's wonderful to listen to again about Airbnb, the Airbnb way. And Joseph knows how to go in and take a look almost surgically, forensically, at what businesses are doing, and then bring it to us in a style that we can understand as laymen who never perhaps will have the experiences that some of the leaders he talks to will. And he decided, and I've got to ask you about this, Joseph, as this all began, you, of course, do a lot of conferences and meetings and speak all over the world, and you must have felt, things are going to seize up here, all the gears, and I'm not going to be able to do that. But since you're such a prolific writer as well, you turned your attention to what it was that business leaders were going to have to be doing during this period, not only to survive, but to thrive. And you came out with this book called Stronger Through Adversity. Tell us about the origins of this.
Well, first, thanks for having me back. And second, yeah, I think that sign was on the wall that speaking wasn't going to be a face-to-face large gathering phenomena as this virus was moving around the world. But, you know, my journey to this book was a little bit different. So about 70% of my business is actually consulting with the C-suite on how do you bring more customers in the door, how do you keep them once they arrive, and how do you get them to talk nice about you so that they can bring even more of their friends along. So that's what I do about 70% of my day gig. And about 20% is traveling around doing keynotes and speaking and all of that. So I knew that 20% of the business was in peril. The 70% consulting was going really strongly. I mean, as soon as this thing hit, I was on task forces for my clients, and we were trying to figure out how are we going to keep the clients, where were they, what were they thinking, how were they feeling. And so that was going to be fine. I wasn't too concerned about that. I did have in the final 10% of my pie a book that was supposed to come out about Godiva, a client of mine that I've consulted with on attracting customers. And unfortunately, in February, when I was going to go to the Godiva manufacturing plant that's in the United States, they have one in Belgium as well. When I was going to go to the one in Philadelphia, they said, no, February, late February, we're just going to be really super cautious and we're going to cancel your trip. And then they said, well, we're going to not have you be able to do some of the things you were going to do with our New York retail stores or our New York cafes because we're getting really bombed here. And so before you know it, I knew that book was going to be on hold, and I went to my publisher and said, hey, based on these experiences on these task forces, I'm seeing a lot of diversity in the way leaders are approaching the crisis. What if we were to try to collect what they're doing and get the voices of them and their colleagues and put a book together, 140 interviews and conversations later, Stronger Through Adversity is out in the world.
And I guess the question I would have is, do you think that the lessons learned, because, of course, you had this wonderful quote at the beginning of the book, a smooth sea never made a skilled sailor. So now you've got leaders who have gone through some of the roughest patches anyone could imagine with unthinkable circumstances about the dispersal of their workforce, the frantic nature of what's going on with their customer base, the inaccessibility to many individuals one-on-one. I mean, it just was so difficult at the beginning for us to get our arms around how do we do all of this. Do you think that the lessons that you are able to put in this book are things that are really going to serve us well going forward and will stick in the long term?
Yeah, because I think, you know, lots of the other crises we've faced, they've affected one part of a leadership community or another, right? If you're in financial services, you might have got hit in the economic downturn, and, you know, any number of other industries get affected in some parts of it, or a part of the world gets affected more than another. This was the most ubiquitous gut punch that leaders took in the last 100 years, for sure. And so I think the fact that we were, if we're going to stay with a metaphor of sailing, I think that we're all in the same storm, maybe on different boats, but it was the same storm and nobody could navigate around it. We had to navigate through it, is why we have an opportunity to really learn from this one.
You know, a lot of CEOs left major corporations at the end of 2019. It was a trend that I detected, and Joseph, I did a separate podcast on that. I'm wondering whether you ended up finding a lot of people who were in these positions on an interim basis or had just started, or whether it made any difference whether they've been long-term, long haulers in a company, or whether they had just arrived, as to their willingness to change and operationally handle things differently.
Oh, and first off, I heard your podcast on that. It was brilliant. And frankly, it was so astute, and I saw it. I really did. I had, you know, I'll give you an example. The guy who's in charge of the FTD, his last name is Cole. I'm forgetting his first name. He's one of 140 interviews, but he was amazing. He took over. They've gone into bankruptcy in 2019, and the chairman of the board was running it for an interim position, and then they finally select somebody toward the end of 2019. He onboards the week after there's a complete shutdown of the operation, and then there's all these holidays that require flower deliveries to come, and they have some problems, you know, getting some of that pulled off, but he'd never met his leadership team face to face. Right. I mean, this is a talk about adversity and challenge. And what I love, his motto, his credo, when he's introducing himself to everybody, he goes, look, I just have one credo, and that is no hiding bad news. I mean, look, you don't know me. You don't know anything else about me, but this is the one thing I need you to know. I just can't have bad news hidden from me. And I just think you're seeing a lot of that among the people that I met. And then there were a lot of them that only made it a couple of months into the pandemic and things went south badly. And they had to switch out. So, for example, you know, one of those is Sukhinder, who was the CEO of SubHub. And if you can just think about what happened in the beginning of this thing, events were canceled. I bought a ticket from you, and now StubHub is the marketplace. And how are they going to get money from you? Give it to me. And so their decision on that was to give 120% value for future purchases, but no refunds on your existing transaction. And so she wasn't long in the position, Sukhinder Cassidy, but really nice lady. Just, you know, a lot of CEO change.
Absolutely. Now, I just want to make certain people understand a couple of things. One, you talk to people in the private and the public sector. You talk about these timeless values, really. Empathy, authenticity, self-discipline, communication, very important. Adaptation and innovation. It would seem like these are the things that you always look for in a good leader, but they have to be accented or emphasized in a new way during a pandemic.
Yeah, really, it's exciting how you summarize that. It's probably better than any summary I've done in my own book, so thank you. But let me kind of to take the leadership differences here. I mean, you know, I think one classic example in the book is I heard from senior leaders of, and when I say public, I should be really careful. I didn't interview any politicians at all. I interviewed, you know, public safety individuals, you know, fire chiefs and police chiefs and the like. And then I did CEOs and C-suite level people in the nonprofits, so the United Way and all of that. And then we did all of the for-profit C-suite. So just to make sure that I have the right context for this. But what I heard from a lot of these leaders were that they used to have a preferential leadership style. They used to maybe lead from the front. They were really comfortable doing that, or maybe they were kind of a blend-in team member leader. But in this context, they found themselves really having to move quickly from the front to the middle to the back. So they were shaping team behavior by being right next to their teams. Michelle Gass, who is from Kohl's, was actually in these stores as they were kind of downsizing and as they were reopening. So you saw a lot more of the kind of fluidity of, I'm going to be with you. I'm not going to ask you to do things that I would not ask myself to do. Then I would lead from the front and tell you the vision and the path. And then I would sometimes drop back and let you come up with your ideation and innovation. And then I would nudge you along as a leader to keep the pace.
I love the way you describe it in the book. A leader needs to know when to show the way, clear the way, and get out of the way. And, you know, clearly, I know you didn't talk to any politicians, but when I do read your book, it's pretty clear to me that a lot of these leadership capacities that you talk about in the book were absent in the previous president, if you will, because he couldn't do some of these things and decided not through adversity to do some of these things. But we won't talk about that in any detail. But it's clear that you really give us so many signals as to what true leadership is. And during a period like this, we've seen it on so many fronts. You know, when people talk about whether our leaders are up to the challenge in many of these sectors, I will tell you that there is some new research out that I saw in addition to your book by Willis, Towers, and Watson, a group that evidently is very skilled in looking at this. And they say that 9 in 10 workers say that their managers have done a good job supporting them during the COVID-19 crisis. Given that you've looked at leadership in corporations for so long, does that surprise you at all?
Not at all. I think people, you know, first there was a valley and there was a rally, right? The valley was so vast and then these leaders rallied. And I saw such changes in behavior. Look, people weren't conducting business from the boardroom. They were conducting business from their bedroom, right? That changed the dynamic. There was a vulnerability. There was a opportunity to be real in ways that leaders often fear doing. You know, we have this, as much as we've done all of this advancement of servant leadership or authentic leadership, in the end of it all, we still hide behind a mantle of I have authority and I must appear like I'm much more flawless than I am. And I think you saw leaders get real with people and real in the messaging. You know, we weren't trying to control the narrative that emphasizes the opportunities and minimizes the challenges. It was a beautiful time of authenticity. Now, will it stay is a great question, and that's why I hope the book is there to kind of remind people that this works, people. It works. You don't have to take the imposter syndrome.
And keep your pajamas on. You do a better job as a leader when you're in your pajamas. Stronger through adversity, Joseph Michelli is with us. You do say something that is quite intriguing. In the book, you said that it showed the limits, all of this in terms of leadership in companies and nonprofits, of participatory management, yet the priority of performance by command and control leadership didn't work either. So there's a middle ground that you're suggesting really is the best place to be as a leader.
I was on one of these teams, these task forces, and I can remember vividly them saying, well, we need to send this back down to these two committees before we can make a decision. I'm like, we will be unemployed by tomorrow if we have to send this down to the next two committees. But I loved the spirit of it, right? Like we want to get the voice of these folks. Well, we don't have time now. And then on the other hand, I had people who were saying, okay, we're just going to do this and people are going to have to get over it. Like, well, I don't think that's it. I mean, we have to find a time between somewhere in here. We can't overanalyze. I think it may have been, you know, Socrates who said the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, the overexamined life isn't worth living either, right? And so we can't gaze at our navel here. We are in trouble. And then on the other hand, this notion of we don't know what the data is. We have no intel on what customers want, think, or feel. We don't know what our team thinks or feels, but we're going to just do it anyway. Wow. Well, then what is guiding this decision other than an impulse? And so I think you saw really the great leaders find the balance. And it wasn't easy. It was hard to find a signal from the noise, but they kept finding the signal and they didn't plan too far out. I said, okay, what's our mission for today? Right. And we're going to meet in the morning. Mm-hmm. We're going to execute the mission and we're going to debrief tonight. And then based on that debrief, we'll set our mission for tomorrow. And then as we got a little more information and a little more trend data, I like that word trend, we get a little more trend data, right? Then we can start to move things a little farther out in our planning cycles.
Well, Joseph organized the book into four main themes: set the foundation, build connections, move with purpose, and harness change in this book, Stronger Through Adversity. Set the foundation. You started off by talking about the personal attributes of individuals and the fact that unless you as a leader keep your work life balance, and if you start to deny the self-care needs that you have, I mean, you have to be strong yourself. And when I was the leader of a team, I remember I tried to exercise every morning before I came in, so my mind was clear. But you found that at the beginning of this pandemic, there were a lot of people having real difficulty with that.
Yeah, Stephanie Linnertz, who's a president for Marriott, you know, she's so candid. She said, look, I had furloughs that I was contemplating on a monumental scale. These are human lives, right? I can't let myself not work 20 hours a day to kind of wrestle with that challenge. And then at some point she starts to say, if I do this 20 hours a day, I am incapable of wrestling with these challenges that keep coming, right? And there's this awareness that we may buy into a narrative that says, you know, leaders need to be selfless. Leaders need to put their mask on first, in the reference to a safety oxygen mask and a flight instruction. But in reality, we do need to put our masks on first so that we are capable of taking care of our teams. And moreover, so our teams see that they can do that themselves and that we're not creating a culture that says everyone must work 20 hours a day. Look at me, right? And I think it was really exciting to watch leaders, you know, shift their perspective on, oh my God, this isn't a sprint. This is a marathon. I'd better train for a marathon.
You know, that's a great point, because I think a lot of people at the beginning thought, well, somehow with our ingenuity, our science, we'll figure this out and we'll be back to the norm within 3 months. Nobody can believe how long it is going on. And of course, it is going on with us being reminded daily about this focus on safety. And you do talk about that in the book, and I'm fascinated with that. How many companies have had to do so much to make certain that all the hygienics around their company are at the highest level possible to protect their employees, to get them to even want to come back into a workplace, and then, of course, their customers. And that, to me, is going to be a really critical component as to how long these measures are going to be taken into the future, even when we're told we're out of the woods.
Yeah, I remember a time when the cleaning crew was on the bottom of the food chain. You know, things have changed, people. We are living and dying. I mean, commerce and employment in the social contract of both now have our lives on the line. And that is just not something that most leaders were thinking about. They always had security running in the background. I mean, we all kind of talk about it, but not much. And now all of a sudden it's in the front and foreground, and there's hard to find anything else in the foreground.
Now, you've got a section called Leave the Island, Follow the Terrain, meaning that there was a lot of resistance and denial at the beginning of this. I mean, how many people really lost their way? I mean, the people you talked to, the 140 or so, who really said, I'm lost here, and it took me a long time to get my bearings, or I just am not the right leader for this moment.
Yeah, I think most of them figured out how to adapt and rose to the moment. I really do think most did. Though I think the point is that we all had a plan going into 2020. We had a strategic plan. We had some great looking objectives. We had a technology roadmap. We had it all, man. It was perfect. And then this tiny little submicrospopic organism, the width of 1/1000th the width of your human hair, is able to dislodge everything. And some people were unwilling to accept that that could be possible, and they clung to their roadmap despite the fact that their map was not syncing up with the terrain in front of them. And so the key was to figure out, how do we use our eyes, our ears, our senses to try to read the data of what's coming at us and put the map to the side because it's distracting. So I think you saw that. The other, leaving the island, the real message here is John Donne's message, which is, you know, no man is an island unto himself. And I think in the time of crisis, I saw leaders bonding together across industries. I saw leaders who would otherwise have been competitors getting together. There was a group of nonprofit leaders who, in these nonprofits, you know, Salvation Army is trying to get your money, United Way is trying to get your money in terms of donations. They are not necessarily collaborative, but in the context of not having any kind of protection on the salaries of employees of nonprofits, they all banded together to try to get, you know, Congress to appreciate that they employ a lot of people, and the PPP type of funding should not be excluded from nonprofits. In the travel industry, there were resorts that are really fierce competitors, but they recognize that particularly in the travel industry, which has been so hard hit as a result of this, that they really needed to use that association that they had developed to work collaboratively in ways that they had never considered in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I had the president of Club Med just telling me that if we did not bond together in our storytelling about what we were committed to do on behalf of safety, then we're going to all die, and we're going to die pointing fingers at each other saying we're better at this than they are when people's anxieties are so high to start with.
When you look at the leaders, you also look at their employees to some extent, because they're going to tell you that they can't do a whole lot unless their team is really still with them, is still, you know, there to take all of the confusion that surrounds a situation like this and make the best of it. How much did leaders learn about the teams that they had built prior to the pandemic and their relative strengths, particularly when there are probably some who are much better, and you hear this from a lot of people, Joseph, you know, I feel so much better when I'm in the office, I can walk over to the next desk, we can chat about something, I can use it as a safety valve, then go back and do my work, as opposed to me sitting at home, and particularly with a lot of distractions, you know, we haven't talked about that, but so many people being heroic in their own personal circumstances, having to juggle more things than they ever imagined.
Yeah, it is a complete disruption of the way we interact with one another in the traditional workplace. And so some leaders, I think, were just much better at making those natural collisions happen through technology, kind of bringing people together, making sure that there were contacts and interactions that weren't all about the mission, and just engaging people. I love Steve Cannon, who I used to know when he was the CEO of Mercedes-Benz USA, but now he's in charge of the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta and the Atlanta Falcons and the PGA Superstores and a variety of other things. But he, you know, was basically doing these CEO lunches and inviting people that he would not normally even interact with, and bringing people together just to interact with each other, no business, just a lunch. And then he would have them bring an item with them from their house. He'd just say, go grab something that means something really important to you. And then they would bring their dog or their kid or, you know, a wedding picture, and they would just show and tell. I mean, I think about it, it's kind of like kindergarten for us, but it was fabulously received. It was about making those informal connections that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do in a technological environment.
What about the differences between leaders who had people who had to stay on the front lines? There was no way that their work could be outsourced or could be done at home, versus those who had that ability because it's more of a white collar situation, and they could all retreat to their own settings and do their work. How different was having to lead one versus the other? Because with the frontline workers, I mean, if you're working in retail or what have you, you've got to be there, and you've got immediate crises that have to be dealt with because customers are so frantic. You don't have the supplies. Supply chain became something we had never really discussed before, and people were out of sorts, clearly.
Well, I think leaders who did this well got everybody together essentially and said, you know, some of you are blessed by virtue of the freedom to stay home and be out of harm's way. Some of us are blessed by the fact that others are out there doing those jobs when we don't have to. We need to structure our compensation accordingly. You're kind of being compensated because you can stay home. That's a benefit you have, right? And whereas the other person needs to get some kind of benefit for putting themselves out there. And so you'd see something like an Elevations Credit Union, which is a relatively small but amazing credit union out of Boulder, Colorado. They've won the Malcolm Baldrige Award, which is just kind of unheard of for an organization of their size.
And by the way, Malcolm Baldrige was a business leader in my home community of Waterbury, Connecticut, with Scoville Manufacturing, a remarkable man.
Yeah, and really helped us all understand how to compete globally and what were the drivers of great businesses. So, I mean, we owe a debt of gratitude to him untold. But that award really evaluates, you know, companies that really are on the cutting edge of all functional aspects of an organization. Well, this particular little credit union, they, you know, the leaders there, Jerry Agnes and his team, he's the CEO there, they just said to everyone, look, how do we make sure that the people in the front line are being adequately compensated? And then they just came up with these bonuses for the front line, the people who had to stay there in the teller positions, right? When the rest of folks could retreat to the safety of their homes. And it was a collective acknowledgement that we needed to make some sacrifices with our resources. And some people were sacrificing in some ways, and other people needed to sacrifice to make it all work. And I loved that kind of mindset, the leaders that could help paint that picture. So there wasn't a we against them. It's like we are all having to make some compromises here, and let's acknowledge those and the benefits that we all can derive.
I took one quote from your book that I thought was really instructive. There was this need to balance swift action, and a lot of people probably felt, oh boy, I got to turn this ship around. And as we're using the ship metaphor again, it's hard to turn a tanker around very quickly. And those who risked moving too swiftly, and they were making bad judgments early on.
Yeah, and I definitely talked about speedboats and freighters. You know, I think this was a time when the big organizations that moved too slowly before this, who had too many layers on it or feared too much losing brand equity and everything had to be checked and rechecked, they had to learn how to let go of some of that. It wasn't your equity that you were concerned about. It was your future, right? And then you had these brands that had just, you know, kind of startup engines, and they were like speedboats flipping all around in the water. They had great maneuverability, but they weren't very stable. And so I think the goal was to try to figure out how did you get sufficient amount of stability. You had to take care of your outflows, for example. You had to make sure your funding sources were right. You needed to evaluate your talent and make sure you preserved your most talented people who had the most critical roles. And then you had to make decisions in accord with your mission, vision, and values, as well as your short-term objectives. Other than that, it was an easy game to play. And it's the same game today, unfortunately. So much of it has yet to change. And I think even when we come out of all of this, there's going to need to be that constant balance of nimbleness with stability that many brands had lost sight of. There are many legacy brands now that are acting like entrepreneurial brands because of the pandemic.
Well, Amazon has always had that day one mentality. And Jeff Bezos says, when it's day two, well, you know that we've accepted the status quo and we're ready to begin to falter. And he said, one day Amazon will falter. I mean, he's very realistic about that. There's always a faster gun at some point. You tell us that we really need to use this as a moment to focus on value over profit, because there were a lot of companies that had to say to themselves, look, we are not going to be making the money that we once made because people aren't going out or people aren't shopping in the way that they did, or they're having to harness their resources because they are limited. So we've really got to take the long-term proposition. And as you know, Joseph, so many in American business have been discredited for their focus on quarterly earnings. What happened to that? And will that focus of value over profit remain as we move along?
Well, I think you can do both, right? I mean, and I think the value is the driver, the thing you need to put in your mind, because if you take your eye off of that, the profits will fade away over time. But let me give you a quick example. Bauer, which is a hockey company, a hockey equipment company, they realized that when the NHL stopped playing, so were going to be all the other leagues downstream, and that was going to be a difficult time for their profits around their traditional product offerings. But then they said, well, how do we create value given what our core competencies are? So they start making face shields. Not a big, you know, departure away from the fact that they have to put on all kinds of other, you know, materials that are protective devices. And lo and behold, that was a value play. And it also was a value to a society play. And it was a bridge to somewhere where they could get back to doing the things they could do when the conditions were more favorable. So I think for me, it's just like, where do we deliver value?
What do customers want, need, and desire? And some of that means we're going to have to change quickly, because what customers need today isn't another pair of skates. They need protective shields so they can do their jobs.
I'm glad you said protective shields. I thought you were going to talk about dental implants. But you say that true leaders will come out of the pandemic having reviewed what they've always done and replaced legacy habits with new learnings. I guess that would be the best thing that could come out of this. And also their plans for risk assessment. Because even before this, when I would talk to people like you, they would always say, well, these companies are really looking at these what-if scenarios. What if this happens? But I don't think there was a what-if scenario quite like this one in everybody's mind.
Well, I am so with you on that. I mean, this was beyond almost every wargaming strategy I had. I can tell you I had been doing some what-if scenarios with my clients that were a little different. I had a company that actually sells home improvement supplies, and they sell it in a home. And so I kept saying, people, you can't continually sell everything in the home in a two-hour appointment. This is not going to work. Someday you're going to have to be able to sell this online. And so we would do these exercises where we would say, let's imagine there's a government restriction that says no more Fuller Brushman knock-on-your-door salesman things. You can't ever sell in a home again. How would you stay in business? Right? We never anticipated that it was going to be a pandemic that would create the government regulations that would then cause it to be impossible for you to go in someone's home. But we were already wargaming a VUCA kind of world, you know, this volatile, uncertain, you know, world that was about us that we needed to restrict ourselves from thinking we can only do it the way we've always did it.
And what about technology in all of this? Because we were always looking at technology as one of those things that ultimately we're really going to have to step up our game. The competitors are. We've got to get much better at this. Of course, telemedicine, some say, has moved forward about 10 years just in the span of the last few months. So what have companies taken away about their focus on technology? And even in that process, security, because if everything they're doing is now going to be online, there we go, needing more security experts to help us protect all that information.
Yeah, I spoke to Matt Renner, who's the president of Microsoft Enterprise Commercial, and he, you know, he was in charge of Teams, and he's watching his group try to roll out Teams on scales they never imagined. The digital transformation has advanced the roadmap for most companies, maybe 5 years ahead of where they were planning on being at this particular point in time. So it is undeniably a tool that kept us alive. Imagine trying to survive this pandemic in the 1980s with a flip phone, right, and no cloud technology. So, it's definitely been a salvation point. I think that the flip side of this is that technology without humanity is not going to get you there. So you need to create a very digital journey for your customers where they can opt into all digital, no touch, you know, e-commerce, all those things. But you also have to have people available to be on these video Zoom conferences who really know how to engage other human beings, even with the extra challenge of doing it on a digital platform. It's technology was our salvation, and I think people finally got the religion, because many of them would not even be in business had they not.
When we suspended normal, of course, there were tough decisions to be made. I mean, we've been talking about it as a positive that we were able really to see certain attributes in people that perhaps we didn't know they even had. But there were tough decisions and will continue to be during this pandemic. Layoffs, streamlined operations, fewer shifts. What does that do to a company that comes out the other side looking a little bit skeletal from when they went into this?
Well, I mean, some of it is—it was going to be better, right? Like some of what we do is we just collect more and more and more. So we have to thin out some of the things that are, you know, just to create growth. You know, for any plant or organism, we have to kind of create some space and prune back on things. So some of that's going to be necessary. If they prune too far, maybe the good news is that there's a lot of folks out there who are still available to be brought back into your organization. That's kind of bad news for the people who are still out there waiting to find their way back. But there's still a population of, I think if we go into this a little bit farther and more people are being absorbed and you're not on the cutting edge of bringing the talent back in that you need, then you're going to be way, way behind. because now what's going to be left in the market is not going to be what's going to get you to the top of the heap.
It may be counterintuitive, but there have been many companies launching or growing during this period. What would you say about their experience where they saw an opportunity as a result of this adversity and they really jumped into a void?
Well, I mean, that's where many of the great revolutions on the backside of adversity have come from. If you look at the Great Depression and the kinds of companies that merged in the backside of the Great Depression because they saw emerging, gaping human need. Look at Zoom as our classic example. Now, Zoom was in play before the pandemic. I know some people may not believe that, but it really was. But now the valuation of Zoom relative to the valuation of the big three automakers in the United States is an interesting study to have, because this company is now worth more than the cum of those three, right? How can that possibly be? Well, because the need met the innovation. And some companies saw a need and they innovated in the midst of it, which is even more interesting and exciting. And we have examples of that that we share in the book as well.
In closing, is there anything that we should be looking for going out to 5-10 years as a result of the pandemic that we haven't focused on, because we do look ahead at trends on this podcast, as you've been doing? Anything you see that we should keep our eye on that may not be apparent to somebody just looking at the broader landscape?
Yeah, I think that there will be a reflection point back on this. God knows when we really can think this is in our rearview mirror sufficient that we can really fully pull the trends out and not noise. But I think one of the things that we will see when we look back is that technology was fabulous, but we also had to have people and we longed for the human connection. So the technology is only going to get you so far. It's going to get you a long ways. But you better have people around, because we are aching to be in the human presence. It's a powerful force. And it may cost us even more time and recovery, right? I mean, if we jump the gun on that, we may set ourselves back in terms of being able to move our economics around.
Absolutely. Well, a portion of the proceeds of this book are going to direct relief. Joseph Michelli, what an honor again to talk with you. Stronger Through Adversity. I know there are going to be a lot of books written about this moment in time, but if you really want a snapshot of what was going on in real time during the most critical moments that business leaders had to make these crucial decisions, this book is about as good as you'll find, because Joseph put such heart, soul, and intelligence into his work. Thank you so much for being with us today once again on America Trends.
It's awesome to have been here. Thank you.